Is Satan's attack on Job typical of his methods in dealing with humans? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Tonson, your host and study guide author. We continue our series on the book of Job, and my conversation partners are again Dave Thomas, Dean of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Jen Ogden, Associate Pastor of the Walla Walla University Church. And I want to press that question that I raised here. Does what happened to Job, is that typical of what happens to people today?
I think of some people, but I wouldn't say of all people.
I think human suffering is definitely a commonality, but I think the reaction and how Job interacted with it was perhaps different than what a number of people experience today.
But I guess I'm saying something slightly different, isn't it?
Okay.
I think that Satan is not always in a frontal attack against humans.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I would argue that our circumstances today where Satan is silent, nothing happens. You just have disasters.
Well, you also have temptations that catch you unawares.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's not this make you into a big example. I think it happens to a few people, but not too many.
Mm-hmm. No.
I've seen a meme floating around on the internet, and it says, you know, Satan doesn't often show up with a pitchfork and horns. He often shows up as everything you've ever wanted. And, you know, and I think that to be more true in our day and age, where we're satisfied with a level of satisfaction, where we're satisfied with stuff or relationship or whatever it is, and we're perhaps not seeking God, whereas Job was really earnestly seeking God, and he was satisfied in a different manner and method. And I think, you know, for us today, it isn't quite as as this, not exactly the same anyhow.
Well, in a sense, we could say that the story of Job happens thousands, yea, verily, millions of times every day in our world. You have people who all of a sudden, their world falls apart with no explanation.
Yeah.
And I think that, but now what I'd like to do to press that further, let's compare Adam and Eve's contact with Satan and Job's, okay? In Adam and Eve's situation, there was a disguised villain. And there was real live conversation. Whereas in Job's situation, there was an invisible. And there was no conversation. It was silence.
You know, there was no conversation with Job.
Yeah.
Directly to Job. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So which do you think is more like our situation today? Adam and Eve or Job's situation? Where there's silence, no conversation, no obvious villain.
I think I would default to the second one in our day.
Yeah.
Although I think, I do think we fall prey to the same temptation as Eve every day too, though, the idea that knowing good and evil is better than knowing just good.
Yeah.
But no, I think we are more subject to sneak attacks than we are straight on warfare.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's another aspect to Job's story, and it doesn't fit right in here, but let me tuck it in. A final examination. After you've had your conversations, you get a final examination, and Job, it was actually examination from God, and he flunked 0 out of 88. I went through there and counted them up. 88 questions, and Job couldn't answer any of them, see. So that aspect of our lives, we really don't know. Now, Job didn't know that he's up against Satan, but he finally had a conversation with God, and he was willing to simply let that one rest at that point. Now, let's...
I think it's more correct to say the book is silent on whether or not Job knew about Satan.
You can say that.
Because he may have known a lot about Satan.
Well, he probably knew a lot about him, just not by name.
The book is silent on what he knew about Satan.
Yeah. But you see, explicit references to Satan as a supernatural being opposed to God only appears 3 times in the whole Old Testament.
Yeah.
That's Job, 1 Chronicles, and Zechariah 3. Now, there's a rationale. I have part of the written study guide on this. I don't want to take a lot of time to say here. But when Israel got to Mount Sinai, the reason I think that God did not say anything about Satan specifically, it was because they were in a polytheistic world. And they very easily could have worshipped Satan as another evil being. So God simply says, you shall have no other gods before me.
And it's also true, Alden, that sometimes when something is common knowledge, it doesn't get discussed. That's another possibility.
That's another possibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about Job's wife. Collateral damage.
Yeah.
Now, there's one wrinkle here. My guess is that I'm not probably quite right here, but I keep being intrigued by the situation where Job's wife, after he loses everything, she says, why don't you just curse God and die? You see? And Job retorts to her. Now, this is just shortly before Job curses the day of his birth. He's not cursing God. He curses the day of his birth. But his wife says, why don't you curse God and die? I like to play around with the fact that in Hebrew, the word curse and bless is exactly the same word. So it might be possible to portray Job's wife as a very godly, devout person.
I never heard that before.
I don't think
so
I have.
So bless God and die?
Yeah. Job, you've lived a full life. Why don't you just simply bless God and die?
Well, I think his response to her indicates perhaps that she didn't mean it as bless God and die.
Certainly his response, he says, you talk like one of the foolish women.
Yeah, you sound pretty silly.
You sound pretty silly. But he was at his wit's end too.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Because he didn't curse God. Now, some of the Jewish rabbis, by the way, as we go through, you may want to remember this. Some of the rabbis were so troubled by what Job said in his dialogues. They said that he did, in fact, curse God. And that's why the Lord gave him a double reward in this world and none in the world to come, because he had in fact cursed God. So the strong language, and we'll have a chance to process some of this, which set the friends off because they simply weren't used to talking about God that way or hearing people talk about that God, and that may have been part of what set them off.
I think oftentimes we villainize his wife, but I think maybe she was a misguided saint, because I think she was right.
Yeah,
you know, with the consequence of what would happen if he chose to live his life in a specific way.
I think the issue of collateral damage, as you said a few minutes ago, is a very difficult one. Mm. But it works both ways, you know, that the collateral damage from bad does accrue, but so does the collateral benefit from good.
Yes.
So I am given some ease of thought of mind when I realize that this thing goes both ways, and it seems to be a consequential thing. That if you, it's like you're riding in a car where the driver has an accident, you were along for the ride, and the same is true in our relationships on earth and with heaven. Mm-hmm. Is that you are involved in a relationship that you don't always know the outcome of. And you can pursue good and be overtaken by evil based on things that other people did.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there is no way that we can make, in this world at least, make a nice surgical incision this is the one we're going to tempt. No, it's just catastrophic, and innocent people are dragged in all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, your statement about collateral good, that's the way it was in Sodom and Gomorrah. 10 people could have saved that whole city.
That's true. Yeah.
Amazing.
That's a good example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, one other question here that I think is important when we talk about temptations. Let's take a look at Jesus' three temptations, because Jesus did confront a demonic person. So there was a face-to-face confrontation there. Now, the three temptations, one, turn stones to bread. The other one, to jump down from the temple so that God would bear him up so he would not dash his foot against the stone. Satan was quoting scripture there. And then I'll give you the whole world if you'll simply bow down. Now, let me ask a question. How many of those temptations do you think were real temptations for Jesus? I, for one, could never be tempted to turn stones into bread.
If I was hungry, I could be.
But you can't do it. It's impossible.
Yeah, I know.
If I had the power. Yeah.
You see, and Jesus had just come from his baptism. And in theory, he had the power, see? And so Satan pressed him on that point, see? Mm-hmm. But, if you give a kid a mountain bike and tell him to not go any faster than 45 miles an hour up this hill, that's not a temptation. It's not possible. But if you give a Porsche to someone and tell them, I want you to go any faster than 40 miles an hour on the freeway, that now is a real temptation. And so when you have the temptations here in Jesus. He had all this enormous power, but could not choose to use them. As I look at those temptations, it seems to me that the only one that was a real temptation for Jesus was the first one, because he had the power. I don't think it had much to do with appetite at all. Sure, he was hungry, but the real question was whether or not he would use his power in ways that were not helpful to defend himself. But I can't for the life of me think of why he would want to cast himself down from the temple. I don't think that was a temptation for Jesus at all.
Maybe this was just a precursor to the temptations that we would really face, and how they could be eschewed, and you know how we could turn away from them in our own lives. Jesus did have power that perhaps we don't tap into, and I certainly don't have in and of myself, but that I have access to through him. You know, so that's a beautiful thought, that he showed me a way to grow beyond where I stand today.
Now, can we draw any lines of practical applications? Jesus' three temptations were specifically for him. What do those symbolize in our lives that might be? Worship me and I'll give you the whole world, for example.
Oh, I think I would have failed the first one, because when I'm hungry, it just turns into a terrible hangry day, right? I get really grumpy when I'm hungry. So I think I would have failed at number one.
We're
like, yeah, bread sounds good.
Except that you can't do it.
Except I don't have the power.
Well, I think the temptations of this world that come in upon us are pretty deadly. And here's where I think the way Jesus dealt with temptation, as we read the rest of the gospel stories, they can be very instructive for us. Job's temptations, he didn't really have temptations in the same sense. He just lost everything. And now his only question is, what do I say to God? So if that's the question, let's come back to Job's, to the question that Satan asked. Does Job fear God for naught? The question of bribery. Did God bribe Job?
I wouldn't use the word bribe, Alden. I mean, I think God holds out a preferred future, a beautiful future, to those who serve him. But I hope that's not a bribe. Although I do think there are some people who follow God now because of the reward. But there has to be more than just a reward in mind.
Well, I think to use a bribe, I think God would have reacted against that. He says, no. My man Job is a good man, and he'll respond in that way. But our time is up, so we must look forward to next week, and we'll have the same conversation partners. And next week, we will talk about God and human suffering. My thanks to Dave and Jen, and my thanks to our program engineer, Jared Miller, and to all of you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.